right, there's that. And this thing, okay, this is Apologetics 101, Session 2. And we're, again, page 14 of your outline. We're talking tonight about how does one study apologetics, and then we're going to talk about how does one use apologetics, basically on the street. So before you go on the street, though, you have to do some homework. You have to be a student. And I was just talking to a gentleman outside in the parking lot, actually. He took classes here for about 5 years and finally had a conversation. He had enough material to work with to have a conversation with his sister, who basically denounced Jesus, became a Jew from being a Christian, oddly enough. So he came to this school here and got himself educated and was able to have a good conversation with her in front of her rabbi. And apparently it went really well. And so he was telling me about that. But that's just an example of the level of commitment to learning that is necessary when you're doing apologetics. It's a huge, huge undertaking and a lifelong process. So like I mentioned last week, we're really thinking about this in terms of a lifelong goal for ourselves, not something where we could just come to this class in the next 6 months and leave thinking that we know everything there is to know about apologetics, God, physics, all this stuff. So tonight, if you look there, we're at the bottom there. How does one study apologetics? Well, by the first thing we got to do is we got to understand grace and truth. And one of my... Yeah. Oh, sorry. This is the most important part. So you may find out that I like jokes to start the class. Bob does these a lot. So it helps kind of open our mind here. This is my favorite.
That is funny.
Yeah, I think Jeff, our newcomer here, may need one of these. He's the only bearded guy here. Okay, so now that we got the most important things out of the way. Okay, so the first thing we got to do to understand how to study apologetics is we have to understand the difference between grace and truth. John 1:18 says, for the law was given to Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. So sometimes you're going to find, by the way, I have John 1. If you can just follow along with your pen and kind of fill in some things that I may be saying that isn't there. John 1:18. For the law was given to Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. So Jesus brought something very different than what was around before. He brought the truth, but he did it in a graceful manner. And this is the approach we want to take as newcomers to this material. We want to understand how Jesus went about apologetics. And so if you read the Gospels, he comes across so strongly sometimes, so harshly. It almost sounds like he's mad and angry and kind of maybe even insulting at times. So Jesus brought the truth, but he did so in a way where he had to confront the issues of the day with the Pharisees. He had to do that in an authoritative manner. But he also had another side to him where he's used grace. And you find that also in the Gospels. And one of my favorite definitions of love, I'm not sure where this came from, but love is grace and truth. Love is grace and truth. And it's not that difficult to think about, but it helps us to understand the different natures of love. In the same way, it helps us to understand the different natures of Jesus Christ and how he went about convincing others that he was God. So we could talk about this a little bit more later. So we're just going to say, see how does one use apologetics, the section below, for matters of the heart. And we'll get into that hopefully in the next session. So it's kind of the same concept. So we'll talk about this more later. So item two there, by understanding knowledge from authority versus knowledge from faith, okay? So this is another way we start understanding apologetics. We have to start by understanding the difference between knowledge from authority versus knowledge from faith. And way back in the 4th century, the theologian and philosopher Augustine of Hippo, known as St. Augustine to many of us, believed based on an awareness of God in a powerful conversion experience. But also, he believed based on authority. So the authority of the church had a role to play in the conversion process of St. Augustine. Augustine basically believed for two reasons. I'm starting the sentence here with because. Augustine believed basically for two reasons. Because the authority of the Catholic Church said that Christianity ought to be believed, and because of his profound conversion experience. He had a profound conversion experience. Does anybody know about the life of St. Augustine? Okay. That's right. Yeah, so Augustine, again, early church father, one of the greatest minds perhaps, not only in the church, but the world has ever seen. The guy was absolute genius, and theologically, he basically was 1,300 years before his time, because the reformers basically took his material and used it to basically spark their literature, which led to the changing of Europe and the Reformation. So Augustine was just absolutely brilliant. And he wrote this book, Confessions, where he detailed his conversion experience. He was a lawyer. He was trained in law in ancient Rome, then moved to Carthage, which is kind of where Libya is, actually, and was a bishop there. And I'm not going to get into this whole life story, but he was one day, he basically was a rebel. He had a mistress, or he was just an adulterer. He was not married. And he goes back to Rome for some teaching opportunities he had there in the school in Rome, and then he had an extended opportunity to teach in Milan, in northern Italy. So he goes up there to teach law and philosophy, and he walks by this church, and Anselm is teaching, or not Anselm, I think Ambrose. Ambrose was teaching. And he walks in and hears the sermon, and he starts to reconnect with what his mother once taught him as a boy. And later on, after a few months of starting to go to church, he's walking through a garden, and he has this incredible conversion experience where he sees a vision of Jesus, just like Paul, and hears this little boy reading a book in the other lot next to him, and it was the Bible. And something that was read, I can't remember what it was, just stirred in him so strongly, and it caused him to just beg for God's mercy. And so that changed his life. But before that happened, he heard the preaching of Ambrose. He heard what was taught from the church as knowledge, okay, as authority. And this is the point. Is that, if you go to the next page here, that, look at item 3, authority and belief from any authority is vulnerable to criticism. Most non-Christians do not agree that Christianity is true just because the Bible and the church say so. This is the issue of our time, too. The issue of our time, not Augustine's time. When the church said something back in that time, people said, okay, because the church was a new institution. It was, at the time, all over the Mediterranean, and they taught with authority. And so this was beneficial to people because they really didn't have to think too much for themselves unless they were trained in law or Latin or they were theologians. But for us, it's not good enough. We don't take the authority of the church, and because of their position, we don't take what they say as knowledge. So how does one know, because this is the issue, how does one know whether or not the other guy's authority is more truthful or right, say, than mine? Apart from God revealing himself directly to us, we must use reason to figure out what the truth is. So the dilemma is this. Augustine said, faith seeking understanding. What he meant was basically, first believe, then seek to understand rationally. This is the idea in Latin. It's faith-seeking understanding. It's crede ut intelligas, which means believe in order that you may understand. One second. Yeah, well, the thing is with this PowerPoint is that I didn't bring my laptop charger. Yeah, maybe you could try that. The same PowerPoint's on her laptop, so we'll try that. But you can follow along in the notes here. So let's see, where are we? Yeah, you guys can have a seat. Hi.
Number five,
thank you. So this is believe in order that you may understand. So have faith first, then understand second. Believe first, then figure things out second. Well, for a lot of us, we just don't do that. We believe because we first heard. Kind of like Augustine, but he took the authority of the church as how to understand truth. He took what they said as truth. We don't do that in our culture today. So there's a debate that happens between theologians. A lot of theologians, myself included, I'm not a theologian, but maybe a layman apologist, would say understanding seeking faith. Understanding first, then faith second. How many were a part of Campus Crusade at any time? Okay, Campus Crusade. So if you remember the little track that they have at the back of the track, if you're walking through it with someone talking to them about Jesus, there's a little train picture, and at the front of the train, there's this train that says fact on it. Anybody remember this? And then the second train says faith, and then the third part of the train says feelings. So fact drives the train forward, then faith comes second, and then feelings later. And this would be really helpful. It was a helpful illustration at the time to talk with people and use that, because a lot of people didn't understand that. People think faith is something totally different than fact, and Christians believe just because of faith alone. And we're going to talk about how this came about. How do we have this idea that faith is first? We're going to look into this and where this idea came from. So seeing faith, we're at item six there. Let's see, seeing faith. This is what I call real faith. And when I say seeing faith, I'm just contrasting that with blind faith. Okay, blind, obviously we know what that is. And so seeing faith, this is direct seeing. Seeing faith is a trust or commitment in something I know to be true. This is faith based in reality, the ultimate reality of God. So it is also called real faith. And this is my language, real faith, or faith in the reality. Hebrews 11 talks about faith, of course. And when you really get into Hebrews 11:1, there's this understanding, if you get into the Greek words, that faith has something to do with this: certain and active trust in a reliable source. And it's not saying that source is unknowable, but it's saying that source is just not seen. And so seeing faith is compatible with knowledge. It's knowledge in it's knowledge of God. He's the person that is our source. Okay, we're gonna hash this out a little bit more as we go. So faith is not something that produces knowledge. Faith is not a way of knowing something. It's not a method that we extract knowledge from the world. We cannot derive knowledge of God or anything else through the method of faith. It's not a tool that we gain knowledge of God from. You can know something to be true, but not have faith in it. Even the demons believe and shudder, James 2 says. But the demons don't have a saving faith. So you can know something to be true, but not have faith in it. Seeing faith is based in reason and evidence and awareness. So faith is more than knowledge, because it adds a level of trust and commitment to it. It adds a level of action. Blind faith versus seeing faith. Well, any questions at this point? Okay, we're at item seven here. Blind faith versus seeing faith. Blind faith is not biblical or rational or healthy. Seeing faith is. Seeing faith is based in reality. What's the difference? Blind faith is believing something irrationally, meaning that Blind faith excludes real knowledge or real knowing. If you know something, then you can't have faith in it. This is what blind faith tends to say. If you know something to be the case, if I know that chair is before me, then there's no reason to have faith because I already have knowledge of the chair. This is what blind faith says. So blind faith takes a certain realm extent of knowledge and says, this is how much I know, this is how much I need faith to do for me. This is what I need faith to do for me. It needs to get me from here to the end. And that's what a lot of us think about God. We think we have certain knowledge of God, but then there's a bunch of things we don't know, so that's what faith does for us. But that's not biblical faith. Blind faith and reason are not friends. They had a falling out. And I don't know where this term comes from, this falling out. Apparently girls use it a lot when talking about relationships, but I'm using it here. I'm borrowing it from pop culture and the Kardashians and so forth. Seeing faith is believing something rationally. Okay, so seeing faith is believing something rationally. Seeing faith and reason are friends. They hang out. They go to the mall. They talk about guys. They do all sorts of things together. They're very compatible. So people think incorrectly that reason takes us so far and faith takes us the rest of the way. That's what we're saying. Mark Twain incorrectly thought, faith is the believing in what you know ain't true. Very interesting. Faith is the believing in what you know ain't true. This is like coming to a fork in the road. If you're coming down a mountain pass and you're not sure where to go, which way's down. So say you're in Lake Arrowhead, and you're trying to figure out how to get to San Bernardino. And you're not sure how to get down. Let's pretend there's no signs. And you just pick a path. And you just start going down that path. And you just hope that that path will get you to where you need to go. That's blind faith. But seeing faith is different. You see signs. You see different things. Maybe there's more shops as you get down closer to the bottom. Or you just look down the path and you see, that's how you get down. You can see the road taking you there. Or you stop and you ask directions. But all these pieces of evidence you picked up, the road signs, all these things, they contribute to knowledge. And they contribute to faith. This is seeing faith. It's the indicators. It's the awareness. It's the evidence. It's the reasons. Blind faith is kind of like Indiana Jones in The Last Crusade. You remember that scene where he's walking out into the big cavern and he's mumbling some religious language and he steps out and you can't see what he's stepping on with the camera, but when they take it the other way, you see the little bridge he's walking on. That's a leap of faith. This concept, leap of faith, came from Kierkegaard in 200 years ago. We're going to talk about Kierkegaard a little bit later, but this concept of leap of faith is not biblical. This is not something that we should understand as faith. Blind faith, as we call it today, is known as fideism for theologians. Fide is Latin for faith. You may have remembered that from the Reformation time, sola fide, only faith. And faith alone does save us. Yes, that is true. But faith is completely separate from reason in this view. So that is, there's nothing rational, intellectual, or evidential about faith in God. Again, that's blind faith. Seeing faith is based in reasons and evidence and awareness, whereas blind faith is not. And again, we can trace this cultural phenomena that we have today, this understanding of faith, we can trace that back at least 200 years in Europe, perhaps even 400. In my point of view, we can trace it back 400 years, all the way to the time at the beginning of the Enlightenment in Europe where I find the origination of blind faith. There are certain steps that took place over the last 400 years, incremental steps that led us to this understanding of blind faith. It didn't all come at once. Remember from last week, we talked about how ideas change culture. It takes probably a generation or so for the thoughts of the philosophers in the ivory tower of academia to trickle down to the street. And so the same is true for philosophy over the years. It takes time for ideas to develop and become full-fledged and get all their flesh to them. And so René Descartes, we're going to look at the Enlightenment rationalism done by René Descartes. Yes, sir.
Question about blind faith and seeing.
Okay.
I'm a little confused, I think. If someone, say, believes because of a powerful conversion experience.
Yeah.
And that's their
like Augustine.
Reason for faith.
Right.
Which faith is that? Is that blind faith?
No, that's seeing faith. The fact is, we all have seeing faith. We just think it's called blind faith because we misunderstand because of the issues that have come down from us through the generations of bad thought. See, seeing faith, the awareness of the powerful conversion experience of Augustine, that awareness is evidence. For instance, if I'm standing here and I have a direct vision right there of an angel and he's appearing to me, I'm seeing an angel. I'm having a powerful conversion experience. Or, let's take it even closer to home. If I have an immediate awareness of my guilt and this sense of dread, like, oh my God, if I don't change right now, I'm going to go to hell. I can't handle this powerful pain, this burden that's on my shoulders. That awareness of guilt is something that wasn't there before. It's evidence that there's something different happening to me that comes from another source, not my own, and that's what I would take as evidence. So awareness is evidence. Awareness is evidence. We have to remember that. A conversion experience is totally evidence of God, of the existence of my soul, of the existence of mind and not a brain. These things are definitely evidence. Yeah, they're subjective in nature, because another person's not seeing them, but they're evidence. Does that help? Yeah.
So my question was, so I was thinking about like my experience based off of that.
Yeah.
So, like, I didn't really believe, because my parents wanted me to go to church and stuff when I was a kid, and I didn't really make sense. I was just like, okay, I'm here because I'm forced to be here. Mm. And then, but I knew what they said, like what they said about Jesus and all the stuff. But it was like I kind of believe, but I didn't believe. Is that more like a blind faith going in? Until
mm-hmm. No. That's just partial knowledge. So you had faith and knowledge happening at the same time. Faith and reason are friends. They go together. They go hand in hand. When we learn, we have faith. Faith, again, it's active trust. This is Hebrews 11:1. Active trust in something unseen. But it's there. And Hebrews 11:1 talks about a certainty. I was looking at the Greek words last night, even. There's a certainty in Hebrews 11:1 that one has. It says the assurance of things hoped for, right? The assurance. Faith has to do with how certain are we are that something is true. How certain are we are? Are we willing to act on that? And that's what James gets into. He talks about, show me your faith by your deeds. But Paul says faith saves. So, again, faith is both. There's two components to it. So knowledge and faith are friends. And, yeah, partial knowledge, of course, we all have partial knowledge. But that doesn't mean we don't have faith. Again, faith is not something that you have that takes you the rest of the way where knowledge stops. Anybody else? Yeah.
I might be jumping the gun with this question, but I think a lot of people from different religions could say that they have seen faith based on your definition.
Right.
So I'm curious.
Right. So then you would say, again, this goes back to the idea that we have evidence for things, we have reasons for things, and they have evidence for things, and they have reasons for things. And they have their subjective experience. The Mormons talk about the burning in their bosom. That's how they know the Holy Spirit witnesses to them the truth of the things in the Book of Mormon. But so what do we do with that? We could say, well, the Holy Spirit witnesses to us about the things in the Bible. So what you got to do is you have to say, okay, take all subjective experiences down. We cannot use them in this conversation. We're going to look at evidence and reasons and see what happens. See whose truth is more sound and valid and reasonable. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So then someone could say, well, I don't want to talk about reasons. I just want to look at evidence, like historical evidence or like archaeology, literature, stuff like that. then fine, we could do that too. We could do that with them, but we could do that with ourselves. See, we have to start with apologetics first for us. We have to kind of get to know the stuff ourselves before we can take it to the street and start using it, because we could get embarrassed, which happens. So, So the way Christianity has revealed itself to me, or Jesus has revealed himself to me, is that he makes sense in every avenue of life, in every facet of the world, in every field and discipline, science, math, psychology, in every sense, the Christian worldview holds more weight than any other religion or worldview. And Jesus Christ, in my opinion, and what's taught in the scripture, is resoundingly more clear and evident when we look at the world and we try to understand what worldview best matches the world itself. Christianity, in my opinion, comes out in flying colors. Nothing compares. Nothing compares. And you, hopefully you'll see that as the course goes on. Other questions? Okay. So, again, we're going to take a break here towards the end, in about 5-10 minutes. And I'm going to eat some good food, hopefully. Have some good snacks. skepticism, the origination of blind faith. One more thought before we get into this. A lot about what we're about to get into, you may be like, well, I don't want to know this much about faith and reason. Well, there's more to this background material than faith and reason. There's, you can use this background material for the rest of this course, because we're going to get into concepts that are going to be applicable in the science area and definitely the philosophy area. So this is kind of a preview to the philosophical stuff that we're going to get into, like in March or so. And but it's just to kind of whet your appetite and give you an idea of what's to come. So Enlightenment rationalism. How many remember studying this in philosophy classes in college? A couple of us. Nobody else. Okay. René Descartes was a great mathematician. He was the founder of this idea called the Cartesian triangle, used in mathematics, and he was educated in some of the best schools in France. His time, I don't have it here, but he was around the time of Galileo. So right when Galileo was making his discoveries, I believe 1550 or so, René Descartes was starting to get a hold of Galileo's books. They were just published after Galileo was banned by the Catholic Church. And Descartes started to develop at a young age as a great thinker in France. At the age of 22, I believe, he was getting his PhD and becoming a law professor. So later on, though, he turned into one of the best minds that philosophy produced. He sought to defeat skepticism. Okay, this skepticism is the empirical kind. We're going to talk about empiricism in a second. But he used skepticism to defeat skepticism of the empirical kind by trying to find some knowledge, some foundation for knowledge, and build a system, or a skyscraper, if you will, of knowledge based on that certain foundation. So he thought if he was a skeptic, he could tear down all systems of knowledge and then rebuild it on a certain foundation. And his attempt was to show that the soul existed and that later, eventually, God existed. So he thought that if he could tear down all systems of knowledge, he can get to something very certain and then rebuild it, rebuild like a skyscraper, if you will. And so rationalism, because of Descartes, became a big movement in Western European history. Rationalism asserts that knowledge, you can cross out the, is obtained only through the reason of the mind. Okay? Only obtained through the reason of the mind. So that's what rationalism is. It's what can I know if I was just to sit down in a chair and think and not do anything else with my eyes closed. Just think. What could I know? And so he basically set out to to make a separation between the mind and matter. So mind versus matter, maybe we hear this perhaps in sports or things like that. If you do me a favor on a piece of, on the side of your paper there in a white area, if you just draw a horizontal line across your page, and on the top of that line, write in big capital letters, mind. And on the bottom of that line, write matter in big capital letters. Mind over matter, okay? Think of this horizontal line as about 100 feet in the sky. So Descartes said, and this is just a visual, that mind is something very different than matter. The stuff here on Earth is actually material items moving in accordance with a deterministic pattern. So we're all part of a machine. Our bodies, animals, trees, we're part of this deterministic machine that is ongoing, it has been ongoing, set in motion from the beginning of time, and that everything that is physical is something that is part of this deterministic machine. But mind is something very different. Mind is something that is a free agent. It's like, forget that analogy, I was going to say like a superhero or something, but mind is something, it's not like the things of the world. It's very different. So mind is immaterial, it's non-material. And the idea is that Descartes, being a devout Catholic, he wanted to defend the mind from the attacks of the empirical philosophers in England, namely Thomas Hobbes, who was an empiricist. An empiricist is someone who says that we can't know anything unless we can sense, perceive it. So we all have five senses, right? What are they? Sight, taste, smell, touch, hearing. So an empiricist would say the only things we can know are things that we can perceive with our senses, sense data. And Descartes said, well, that's bad news. Because what he read into, which was keen of him, was that the mind would get sucked into matter by the empiricist in England. So he wanted to save the mind from being understood as matter, because he didn't want everyone to be thought of as machines. And so rationalism, again, asserts that knowledge is obtained through reason of the mind. So he said, this was his goal, if I sit down and am a skeptic about everything, for instance, if I look at the sun and the moon, and they happen to be the same size when I look at them, do I assume that they're the same size? They appear to me as the same size. Can I trust my senses, though, and say that they're the same size because they appear that way to me? Or another example, if I have a stick, and I know the stick is straight, and I put it in the water, and I let it float there, lake or river, and I look at it, it appears to me like it's being bent as it enters the water. So Descartes says, well, that stick appears to me as bent, but I know the stick is not bent. So he basically was gathering, as he walked around doing his method of rationalism, that he can't trust his senses. But the guys in England were saying, this is all we can use to get knowledge, is our senses. So Descartes rejected that idea, and because he couldn't trust his senses. And so what he did is he said, well, what can I know with absolute certainty? What kind of concrete foundation can I pour to build my skyscraper of thought on? What could I know that nobody else can say I don't know? What can I not doubt? Because he was doubting everything. And he started thinking, well, I'm doubting this, I'm doubting that, I'm doubting this, I'm doubting that. And then he says, well, I'm doing a lot of doubting, aren't I? And as he kept doing this method of doubting, he realized that a doubt itself is a thought. And in order to doubt, you must think, because it's impossible to doubt unless you're thinking. So he reasoned that if I'm doubting, then I'm thinking. And in order to think, I have to have a mind. Because thinking can't be done without one. Neither can doubting. So that's where we get the expression, I think, therefore I am. Which happens to be one of the most famous sayings in all of philosophy. So he proved that because he doubted everything, he existed. And not only he, but the mind, which is basically the soul. The soul exists because he reasoned that he was thinking. And he could not deny the fact that he was doubting. So he has a certain foundation. So the soul and the body is thus saved from becoming part of this materialistic mechanism, this machine of the material universe.
What did he say the soul is?
Well, that's a difficult question. The soul in classical Christian philosophy is composed of the mind, the will, and the spirit. Some would say it's just the mind and the will and not include the spirit. So if you're a dichotomist, it's just the two. If you're a trichotomist, it's the three. I'm not sure exactly what Descartes was, but I know he would fall into that range. So that's the idea, is that he was able to save the soul essentially from being extinct and going into this world of matter. And his that was his goal in all of this, is he was a devout Catholic. This was prior to the Reformation, or right when it was first gaining its roots in Europe. And so he was trying to do Christianity a favor, but it turns out years later that he didn't do us any favors. It actually harmed the way we think about faith. And so since then, especially in the last 20 years, Christian philosophers and apologists have to clarify Descartes and have to understand really what he did was something negative for us. And again, the reason why it was negative is because he created this unintentional split between mind and matter. By splitting them, it opened up the door for all these other philosophers in the years to come, the next 300 years, to attack Christianity. Some were even Christians. Again, like Descartes, they didn't know they were attacking Christianity, but it actually goes against Christian ideals. And Descartes, again, it was because of the split, mind versus matter. We're going to talk more after the break about the split made by Kant, and then the split of fact versus reason. Any questions? Okay, so let's take a 10-minute break, and we'll be back here, say, about 8:53.
8:53?
Sorry, 8:03. Thanks. Okay, there's decaf, regular coffee, and water. There's water for tea, if you want some. Last thought is that I brought again some of my apologetics books for you to just look through and see which ones you like. Don't take them, but write the name down and go order it on Amazon. Because of Tebow, you know, I've been listening to all this stuff about Tebow for a long time, and it's just been awesome to see, especially this past week at the playoff game now. Like, I've seen newspaper articles.
Do you know that John 3:16 was number one?
I heard about this. Yeah,
Number one researched word. Yeah. And Yahoo and Google, like the day after the game.
Amazing.
And then it. I guess apparently he threw for 360.
Right.
Yards.
And 31.6.
Yeah.
That's so random. It's totally a God thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, thanks for coming, Scott. I know it's super far. I wish it was closer to like Central Orange County to, you know, make people's lives easier, but oh, okay. Yeah. Thank you for your questions, by the way. Okay, we're going to get started. Love the fellowship that's happening here. Warm community feels. little love groups have formed. Okay, thank you again for being so nice and friendly during the break. I'm sure you all will become best friends by the time this is over. And Christians and food and talking just kind of bonds people for some reason. Maybe it's a supernatural thing that Jesus set in motion, but something powerful happens when we have food and when we talk. So, as we take our next step on our journey through the Enlightenment and seeing how Enlightenment thought helped shape how we think now, we turn to the British philosopher David Hume. David Hume lived from 1711 to 1776, and he was the ultimate skeptic. If you thought Descartes was a skeptic and doubted everything, David Hume was much worse. He is a vicious skeptic, and he was definitely a skeptic of rationalism. Again, rationalism being finding knowledge through reason alone. And Hume thought that knowledge can only be obtained through experiment or experience. So this is empiricism as well. When I say experiment or experience, or when you hear a philosopher talk about that, they're talking about empiricism. That's spelled right there in item 4. Empiricism asserts that all ideas or knowledge is obtained through experience or the five senses. So if I do a science experiment, I'm watching the experiment happen, I'm looking at the results of the experiment, and I'm making conclusions. This is all done through my eyes. So again, sense perception, sense data. So we can say that experiments are also part of the empiricist genre. So Hume basically began a movement, or he was part of the beginnings of the movement of empiricism. And empiricism and rationalism went hand in hand in the Enlightenment time, and they still are basically different sub-branches of the branch of philosophy called epistemology. Epistemology meaning is the field in philosophy that says, how do you know things? I'm looking to see that these are recording. Apparently they recorded our break, so hopefully that's okay. Hopefully I didn't say anything crazy. So let's see. Okay, so empiricism is the idea, again, that what can we know through the five senses? Rationalism, what can we know just sitting down thinking and not looking or touching anything? So for the empiricist, the mind is essentially blank until it is filled with knowledge of... Let me rephrase this. For the empiricist, the mind is blank until it is filled with knowledge, cross out of, gained through experience in the world or scientific experiments. So they say basically that nobody knows anything at all unless they've done an experiment or they've done some sense perceiving and gathered knowledge. Babies, anybody. You just don't know anything. Your mind is blank. It's empty. And so again, the only way you can know things is by how you gather the information with your five senses. We cannot know anything in the world unless we have this impression on our mind. Hume taught that you have to have an impression of the thing out there on the mind here, and that's basically what you experience. You don't really experience the world out there. So Hume actually separated mind from the world in a different way that Descartes did. Hume said that you can barely get at all to the things out there in and of themselves. You're basically stuck behind the impressions on your mind. It's like you're looking at a camera lens, you know, when we take photos. That's kind of what we basically perceive. It's our perceiver. It's like we have another camera lens up here. That impression tells us about the world out there. And so he was doubting the world out there as it really is, and says all we can really have access to is this impression on our mind. The impression is nothing we can have gained through rationalism. It's only what we gain through sense perception. So the sense perceivers go out there, get information, they feed it to this impressor instrument, and that's how we gain knowledge. But what he was doing was he's setting up a way to doubt that perceiving instrument. And so the soul and God does not give us facts because we can't sense perceive them. We can't reach out and touch God or the soul. They're immaterial. We can't look at it and know it. And Hume said that even experiments that are repeated, we still can't know if the next time we do that experiment, we're going to come up with different results the next day. So again, he was a vicious doubter. He would even say things like, we know that the sun rises and sets every day, but tomorrow it may not. And so it's just so, you know, extreme. And so our knowledge of the soul and our knowledge of God falls short. Because even if we did have a sense impression of God or the soul, we may be mistaken. Our sense perceiver may be off. And what he said was that it's more likely to be the case that miracles cannot happen than Jesus rose from the dead. Or let me rephrase that. It's more likely that the testimony of the apostles was a lie than that the miracle happened that Jesus rose from the dead. Because if you think about probabilities, Hume taught a lot about probabilities. It's more probable that a human being is lying for some strange reason than Jesus actually rose from the dead. And in a sense, he's kind of right. So how do you refute Hume? A lot of philosophers, even today, say that Hume's never been refuted, which I totally disagree with. A lot of people have refuted Hume. We're not going to do that tonight, but I'm just giving you some of the strong attacks on Christianity way back 300, 400 years ago. That probabilities, our impressions, how we understand the world out there, these are all things that are faulty. These are things that could be mistaken. And if those things could be mistaken, then we shouldn't trust them. And we definitely shouldn't be Christians. Because why would we base our life on something that's faulty? Why would we base our life on something that's so easy to doubt? Yes?
Somehow that doesn't make sense, because if you just claim that for Christian kinds of things, you might as well claim it for all bodies of knowledge, and then you can't be sure of anything.
Yes.
Function.
That's a great point. Thank you. Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
It is a great point. And actually, I read a little bit about him. And after he came out with all this stuff, he actually went into an extreme anxious and depressed state. Like, literally. Because literally, like, what is there to hope for in life, or base your life on, or anything like that? Like, everything's taken away. You have no foundation at all.
This is a great observation, great point. She's not only beautiful but smart. Keeps me straight. So yeah, a great point. I mean, basically this is the criticism of Hume. Hume tore down so much with his skepticism. He basically tried to refute all ways of knowing things so that Christianity would be totally refuted. But what he did is he tore down everything. He tore down too much. And so he's the ultimate critic, the ultimate skeptic. If you're going to be a good philosopher, you have to know how to treat Hume, because he's so impactful. He's basically one of the biggest names in all of philosophy because of this thought. And he influenced us tremendously. And so a lot of people can't take Hume, though, too far, because Hume doesn't build back up a system of thought like Descartes did. Descartes put together the sure foundation of I think, therefore I am. But Hume doesn't give us anything like that. He's just a pure skeptic. He tears down, not builds up. And so you can't be a skeptic about everything.
Because skepticism as a worldview, as a philosophy system, ultimately fails. It goes through infinite vicious regress. And you can't pull yourself out of skepticism if you're a skeptic. It doesn't make logical sense at the end of the day. Yes?
But wouldn't you say that's where we are now? Like, it sounds like postmodernism in a nutshell, kind of.
Great point. So postmodernism, again, is something that has come about that we're kind of in the middle of in some weird way right now. And we are swimming through it. But we may not say that we're swimming through it, and we could reject the idea that we're swimming through it, which is what I do. I reject the idea that I'm stuck behind my senses, my perceiver. I'm stuck behind my grid. And we're going to talk about postmodernism a ton later on. But you can see the relationship in ideas now and to 300, 400 years ago. And again, it just continues down. We're just down the river a little bit. So maybe the tides have turned up some sand and we're dealing with a little bit different stuff, but it's the same kind of stuff. So yeah, after empiricism, after rationalism, we get into this idea called existentialism, and then that leads to postmodernism. I forgot there's something else, phenomenology, a few other things, but then existentialism and postmodernism. So yeah, it's all this stream of ideas, and it gets harder and harder to handle as we go. So Kant, who here is familiar with the work of the German philosopher Immanuel Kant? Anybody? Okay. So Kant read Hume, who was kind of in tandem with him. They lived kind of around the same time. And Kant said that when he read Hume, he was awakened from his dogmatic slumber. He agreed with Hume, saying that we can't know things of God's realm through reason, and we can't know things of God's realm through experiment or experience. So what Kant said was basically that he took Hume and he changed it a little bit. He says, not only can we not know God's realm, God, or any other immaterial thing, we can't know that through reason or experiment. See, Hume said that we definitely can't know it through reason, and we have a faulty perceiver. But Kant says, no, we just can't know it even if we had a good perceiver. We can't know anything about God's realm through perception or reason, through empiricism or rationalism. But Kant then did say that we can know things of our world, not like Hume, through reason and experiment. We can know things of our world through reason and experiment. And so what Kant did, let me read this. Because there was such a thrust of rationalism in Western European philosophy and theology, Kant wanted to bring back faith into the picture of Christianity. So his motive was actually to save this idea of faith, because he thought faith itself was going to get thrown out by the philosophers. And Kant himself was a Christian, a very strange type of a Christian, I think, because he did so much harm to Christianity with his philosophy. But nonetheless, he was some sort of a Christian. And in his book, The Critique of Pure Reason, Kant said that even though he believes God exists, he was skeptical about our ability to know that God exists. So we have, basically what he said was, we have no ability to know God exists because God exists in the noumenal realm, which is the realm of essences, and we exist in the phenomenal realm, the realm of experiences. And we can't use rationalism or the reasoning of cause and effect or even experiences or empirical sciences to know that God exists. So if you do me a favor and you draw another horizontal line across your page, please, in some blank area, and on the top of the line you put phenomenal realm, just how it's spelled there in item 4 on the top of page 18, phenomenal realm in quotes. That's the big word that you put on top. Oh wait, sorry. Phenomenal is the bottom. Phenomenal is the bottom. Don't screw that up. Take out the front part. I'll leave minimal. And then put noumenal on the top, phenomenal on the bottom. And then put in parentheses, just so you know what's clear,
The Realm of Essences by Noumenal and The Realm of Experiences by Phenomenal. And you can see there, when you do that, what sort of separation Kant was trying to put together. Again, we're talking about faith and reason, but these concepts that we're covering will help propel us through the rest of this course in science, archaeology, philosophy, experiential apologetics, cultural apologetics, and like you mentioned, this whole postmodernism concept that we have to grapple with. So the noumenal is this German strange word, and we can all admit that it's weird. This noumenal realm is the realm of essences. So what is an essence? An essence is what Kant thought God was. He thought the soul was an essence. He thought numbers actually are essences. Or we can think of them as abstract objects. Colors, another abstract object or an essence. So colors, all colors, the category of colors themselves, the category of numbers, the soul, God, that's all up there in the noumenal. Think of the noumenal as this 100-foot line in the sky. And everything up there is things that Kant said we cannot know. Because we can't use our rational mind to know them, or we can't use our sense perceptions. But interestingly, he said we can know things in this world, which differed from Hume. We can know things very clearly and easily in this world, the phenomenal world that we live in. So I'm seeing phenomenon right here, phenomena, you know. I think that word phenomena is probably familiar. In his book, The Critique of Practical Reason, he said, we must believe God exists, even though we can't actually know God exists. Even though we can't actually know it, we must believe it. And why? Because we need to have a meaningful theory of ethics and morals, or else we will have a degenerate society. So Kant, in his book The Critique of Practical Reason, he says, practically speaking, we have to believe God exists as a society, or else we're just going to degenerate and become just this strange people group filled with all kinds of immorality, destroying each other. It's not going to work. So we have to believe God exists, even though we can't know it. So Kant separated, he divided the world, item 6, into the realm that God exists in the noumenal and the world in which we live, the phenomenal. And this idea was revolutionary in philosophical and cultural thought. So all we can know is the phenomenal because our world, all we can know is our world, the phenomenal, because our world can be known by experiment and experience and reason. And we cannot bridge the gap between our realm and God's realm. We can't know anything about God. Even though we think we can reason about God, he didn't agree with that. He doesn't think we can actually just sit down in a chair and think about God and come up with God. He doesn't buy certain... he basically, I believe, tore down the cosmological argument for God's existence and was a big critique of it, had a big critique of it. So he kind of tore down arguments for the existence of God. let's see, item 9 here. That since Kant's contribution over 200 years ago, the thought has trickled down through culture to us today, that we can't know that God exists for certain. So for us today, the Western world understands religion and Christianity is that which comes from faith, blind faith, without reason, without evidence. So again, this helps with this idea of where this idea of blind faith comes from, and this idea of subjectivity, which we'll now see in Kierkegaard. So, and this is where apologetics comes into focus, that if Kant is right, we are definitely in trouble, obviously, because we can't prove that God exists. We can't even want to prove God exists. But Kant was not right. And not only can the Holy Spirit reveal himself to us in our inner realm, but we can use reason and evidence to show God's existence and to have knowledge of God. So Kant was not right, because we actually do these things now. And we create compelling arguments for the existence of God, and we have all kinds of evidence showing how we can know God exists. So, any questions on Kant before we get into Kierkegaard? Anything not clear? Okay. Kierkegaard is this interesting figure. Who knows much about Kierkegaard? A little bit? Okay. Kierkegaard was Dutch from Holland. So he was a strange figure just because he comes from there. I like to make fun of those guys up there because they seem, everyone I meet just seems to be a kind of a wiry sort of person, kind of a goofy personality. And Kierkegaard was definitely kind of strange. He, a little bit about him, he was a great thinker, also like Descartes, finished school early, and was very much angry at the systems of philosophy that were going on at the time. Because the philosophers in his area, in his day, said that from Socrates to his day, they were all building and putting together this system of knowledge, this logical, analytical, very defined, regulated system of knowledge and system of thinking. And Kierkegaard said, no, that's not what this, not what philosophy is all about. Philosophy is all about the person, about me and subjectivity. And so he went back to Socrates and said, retraced the history and said, Socrates says, the unexamined life is not worth living, right? Have we heard that before? And so Kierkegaard plays off this idea. He was brought up in a Lutheran church. This is again after a couple hundred years of the Reformation. We see the Reformation spread throughout Europe, and the Lutheran church and other churches gain a foothold, and once was a Catholic area. And so everyone in Holland was Lutheran. They just grew up Christian, and they went to church, and he said, this is so strange. Everyone just takes for granted their heritage and their ancestry, and they don't realize why they're Christians. They don't have a reason themselves to be a Christian. They're just born into it. And so Kierkegaard was mad at these two things. He was mad at the system of philosophy, what was happening at the time, and mad because Christians, which was the entire population of the Holland area, would go to church Sunday, and they just were not passionate. Kierkegaard was a man of passion. He had a basically, he fell in love and he had a breakup with his fiance, and he broke up with her because he basically said that she would keep him from his career as a philosopher. And he was actually probably more heartbroken than her, because throughout the rest of his philosophical career, we see in his writings this passionate man, this man that was filled with emotion. And when you read him, the emotions just, you know, come off the paper. And you're just like, wow, this guy's really into what he's writing. And so he talks a lot about his emotions in his philosophy and in his writings. He says in his book, Fear and Trembling, he argued that faith begins precisely where thought stops. We talked about that. Faith continues where knowledge ends. Even though, he says, as for me, I do not lack courage to think a complete thought. He says that basically, I don't have any problem. I'm not scared to think any thought I want. Nothing scares me. I'm going to think about God if I want to think about God. And Kant, you can't stop me. And so what he says, though, is that there's no reason in this. There's no knowledge in this. It's just beyond knowledge. It's what takes me further. So there's no reason in faith for Kierkegaard. Again, this concept of blind faith. So this is sort of existential Christian philosophy, where philosophy cannot and must not give faith, but philosophy helps one understand faith. And again, this understanding is not biblical. There's a few things I have here about Kierkegaard. We're not going to get into everything here, but I'm going to give you this example that will help understand the rest of this. Maybe you could read on the rest of Kierkegaard on your own, this little portion. Kierkegaard read the book of Genesis, the account of Abraham about to kill his son Isaac. And what he says is that because Abraham had already surrendered to the Lord,
He had already pushed himself to a point in his relationship with God, or he came to a point in his relationship with God where he was totally sold out. Whatever God wanted, he would do. That was already there. Then God calls him to sacrifice his son Isaac. Okay, so if you look at item 9, the IX, strength, energy, and spiritual freedom is what Abraham had to begin with. Then the arrow, it says, then infinite surrender, then faith, then the receiving of everything, the promise that he was to be, or his descendants were to be a blessing to the nations. So that was the receiving of his reward of faith. And so item 10 there, through infinite surrender, one becomes conscious of his own validity, and only then can speak of grasping existence, reality, by virtue of faith. So for Kierkegaard, faith is blind courage into the absurd. If you go back to the Abraham example, it was absurd that God asked Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac. Was it not? It's completely absurd. We would never do that today. And even in that time, the other cultures were sometimes, depending on which one, were sacrificing their children. And they did that as a ritual instead of animals. But God, this was definitely not God's ideal, right? So Abraham heard this. And he was, this is absurd, Kierkegaard says. He said, Abraham must have been thinking, God, you're asking me to do something ridiculous. And so basically for Kierkegaard, faith is looking with his whole heart and whole soul passionately at impossibility, looking at it in the eye, and believing in spite of the absurd. And a lot of times we think of faith like that. We think when all the world is against us, when everything does not make sense, like killing your son, when everything seems super absurd, then I'm going to believe God anyway. Because it's impossible. That's what we think of faith. And you say, well, that sounds pretty good, actually. Well, yeah, it does. But you know what is missing in Kierkegaard is that Abraham had faith in God himself as a person, because God and Abraham had a relationship before that, which is why Abraham had already surrendered his heart to God in the first place. And Kierkegaard pays so much attention on this strange existential moment. He writes this whole book, Fear and Trembling, on the moment of anguish in Abraham's heart that he was experiencing in that time of sacrificing his son Isaac. He just spends this whole book talking about this moment. And it's like, Kierkegaard, give it up a little bit. We get the idea. It's a weird thing. Abraham's tripping out. He's freaking out. But you don't have to freak out about it. But he does. He freaks out about this whole thing. And he forgets this idea of what took place initially in Abraham's heart and mind and soul, that he had a relationship with God. And he knew, he had evidence, and he had an encounter, he had certainty in the person of God himself. He knew God would provide. He knew God would do something. He knew God would have a solution. And so that then he did his act of faith. And of course we know that God provided the ram. But Kierkegaard again gets stuck behind this idea that unless there's complete absurdity, then you really don't have faith. So this is an extreme concept of faith. This is extreme because, like we said, that knowledge can only take us to here and faith takes us here. That's basically blind faith. But for Kierkegaard, he's saying no. And if it's, we have to have things that are against the knowledge, things that are impossible, then we have faith. That's real faith for Kierkegaard, which is not what the Bible says. Is that clear? Does that make sense? Any questions? There's some things that maybe float in your head about, well, I thought faith was this, I thought faith was that. And I'm not trying to give you a doctrinal dissertation on faith. I'm merely pointing out the history of ideas that led to our strange concept of blind faith as we have it today, and our strange idea of subjectivity. Everything's subjective. Everything's subjective. We can't know the objective world because we're stuck behind our subjective experiences. We can't communicate our subjective experiences to other people because they're ours and they're not out there. And so these things are kind of interrelated. So again, in Kierkegaard, you have to have things that are impossible, absurd, and then you have an existential moment, and then you believe anyway. And I studied a lot of existential philosophy for fun, because I was really into it. We're going to talk about existentialism later, but it's a fascinating study, because a lot of Christians think existentially about Jesus, about the world, and it's a little not biblical, it's not really theologically sound. So we have to be careful on how we think about faith and how we think about the world out there. any questions? Okay. Item three. How do we study apologetics? By understanding general revelation versus special revelation. Who here knows about this idea of general revelation besides Toby? Okay. General revelation. Toby, would you like to help us out with this one? No. Yes?
General revelation, under my understanding, is talking about, like, music, reference to Romans, where God revealed himself through creation, through the sea, and then he reveals himself in a way that people, in the end, would not have an excuse. They could come to some understanding of him through nature, through the sun, the stars, and moon, creation. Special revelation would be more like through the person of Jesus Christ.
Perfect. Let's give a hand for Toby. Okay, so that takes us to the next section. Well, actually, basically what Toby's saying is right here. General revelation, the awareness of God or knowledge of God obtained by looking around and making observations. So if you walk around and you start looking at trees, you start looking at the moon, you start looking at water, and you start asking yourself, how did this get here? How did I get here? What's this all about? One could then consider God from that. And so Romans 1, like you said, says that God revealed himself to us so that all men are without an excuse. So people living in the jungles of Africa, people living in, you know, Indonesia, wherever, they are without excuse. God will judge them based on what they know and how they have responded to how he's revealed himself to them through nature. So general revelation, again, is this nature-based understanding of God. Experience, reason, experiment, empiricism, rationalism is part of that process. Page 21, special revelation, like Toby said, is this awareness of God or knowledge of God obtained through the direct experience of God. So this could be a vision, a dream, a miracle, a prophecy. So if I have healing in my leg, which could happen tonight, then I can have direct awareness that God did something to my leg. That direct awareness is kind of this idea of special revelation. The appearance of angel or Jesus would be special revelation. Like he said, Jesus himself is this idea that God is revealing himself to us in a special way. Hearing God's voice, sensing God's presence in the room with you, these sorts of things. Any questions on that? Okay, it is 8:39. How about, can anybody make it the next... Can anybody not make it the next 5 minutes till we get to the next section here, the top of the next section, the next page? If you can't make it, I won't blame you if you need to get up and go. It's totally fine. We're past 8:30, which is when Bob wanted to end, but some of us have driven a long way. Scott came from Kansas tonight to get here. okay. So, how do we study apologetics? By understanding properly basic knowledge and special revelation. So again, this idea of properly basic knowledge and special revelation. Properly basic knowledge is also understood as first principles by philosophers. This is basically common sense. Okay? Common sense. Properly basic is this technical word for common sense. Sometimes this is called by philosophers simple seeing. Okay, I can see things simply, not complicated. Things are not complicated. I see them as they are. Examples. Killing babies for the fun of it is morally wrong. Okay? If I kill babies right now, you're going to say that's wrong, right? If I stab them with a fork. Okay? Right?
Yeah.
This is psycho talk. But there's a guy, Steven Pinker, who actually is a philosopher today, alive, and he thinks that this isn't wrong. Can you imagine? And he has this whole philosophy of this. If I killed that same baby in a jungle where they kill babies as a sacrifice, maybe this culture does this, is it wrong in that culture? Awkward pause. But is it wrong? Yeah. Is it wrong in that culture? But is it wrong in that culture? I'm just going to leave you with that. So, yeah. Right. Or then start killing the humans. Why not? 2 + 2 = 4. Is that true in this classroom? 2 + 2 = 4. Is that true in the culture that kills the babies for fun?
Yes.
I am me and I am not you. Is that true? Is that true in that culture that kills babies? Is it true on Mars? I am me and not you.
No. Because we don't know if there's aliens on Mars. It still makes sense.
Sorry?
Yeah. What if I have my clothes on?
What if you're without clothes?
No, my clothes.
Oh, okay. Either way, it would be weird. Okay. Last example. I see the rock in front of me, and I know it's a rock and not a turtle. It could be a turtle, but I just saw it move with legs. So I know it's not a rock. So again, this idea is just simple seeing. This is a properly basic knowledge, it's common sense. So when you hear philosophers talk about properly basic ideas, these ideas are things that are self-evident. Okay, self-evident, does that word ring a bell? Where do we get that word from? Yeah, these things we know are to be self-evident, the Constitution. So why did they say that? They said that we know these things to be self-evident. All men are free. We have the right to own land. These sorts of things. These are truths that we don't need anybody to tell us. We just are immediately aware of them, and we don't even have to think. We don't have to have a rationalistic system to discover these ideas. They appear to us immediately, obviously. And so, again, this is a way to start your study in apologetics by understanding properly basic ideas. And this will come into a big... this comes into play a lot when we start talking about postmodernism. On the other hand, item C, we also want to have experiences of God as a source of knowledge, because we want to not just know about Him, but want to know God personally. As current philosopher Alvin Plantinga and philosopher William Lane Craig says, through the immediate witness of the Holy Spirit, we can have assurance of the truth of Christianity. We can have a saving faith based in the Holy Spirit's revealing Himself to us. Thus, our faith is the strongest form of simple seeing, of seeing faith, real faith, since it's based on the direct experience of the Holy Spirit confirming Himself to us. So what we're saying here is that we don't even have to have reason and evidence to believe in God's existence. We don't have to have anything else but the Holy Spirit revealing Himself to us. If we have an encounter with God, if He appears to us in this room, We don't have to then be like, okay, God, well, I'm taking this apologetics class. I'm going to go figure out some reason and evidence that's for you to make sure I know you're real. No, we have an encounter with God Almighty. This is the truest form of proof for us. The interesting thing about that, though, is that, again, it's a subjective sort of a thing. We can't sit there and always point to the entire world, hey, look, there's God, and put it on YouTube. And even then, people will doubt, right? So, an example is, if I'm accused of murdering somebody tonight, say tomorrow someone accuses me of stabbing somebody, I have all you as witnesses that I'm here. But suppose you weren't here and I was just in another room and there's no one around. And so there's my word against their word. And maybe there's no evidence. They say I did it, I say I don't. He said, she said. So I have immediate awareness of myself in the room tonight. But again, that's subjective. I have to show at some point reason and evidence that I was in that room. I have to say, look, I sent this email at 8:30. I obviously was at a computer and not stabbing someone at 8:30. You know, I could do things like that. So again, Plantinga, a philosopher, and William Lane Craig, another philosopher, says that if you have a direct encounter with God, you don't need reason and evidence to show or to prove to yourself God exists, because he obviously is the biggest form of proof you could ever have. You can't deny him. His presence is too powerful. It knocks us over, you know, all that sort of stuff. But to show it to somebody else, you need to show reasons and evidence. So you don't have to have a thorough review of all the arguments of apologetics to show or believe in God, or show his existence. You don't have to be a PhD, you don't have to be a philosopher. You could be a child with simple knowledge, a simple awareness of God, and you could know with certainty, certainty that Descartes sought to obtain, you can have certainty in your belief system and can even say that I have knowledge. I have knowledge. That word knowledge has been taken from Christians. They say that we cannot know things with certainty. All we can know things is through, the way we know things is through faith. And so we then are stuck in this box of thinking and living and talking to people, stuck in this thing called faith. And faith is not knowledge. And so what we're doing is we're going back and we're saying, give me back knowledge. I'm taking back what was mine. Jesus gave it to us. The truth shall set you free, he says. And this is about taking that stake in the public square back. We're going back. We're saying, I'm here. I'm going to sit on this corner, and you're going to have to deal with me. Because you cannot tell me that I don't have knowledge. Just because I'm not fully certain of something doesn't mean I don't have knowledge. Certainty is a measure of knowledge, how much we affirm something, how much we hold something to be true, how much evidence, how much reason we have for something. But you can still say, as a child, that you have knowledge, even though you're not fully certain. And Paul says, we know in part now, but then we will know fully. And so again, you can have knowledge, and you can hold on to that word, even though you're not 100% certain. The certainty thing we'll get into next week. There's different levels of certainty. If you're more than 50% certain, that may convict you of a crime. And so depending on how far along your certainty meter is, then you'll be able to say, yeah, I'm 51% certain that God exists. I'm 51% certain that Jesus rose from the grave. Then you can start saying, yeah, I have knowledge. So again, you don't have to have 100% certainty to have knowledge. Any questions? Okay. If anything's not clear, you want to talk, just come chat after. But that'll do it for tonight, and we'll see you next week. Thanks.